Starting something new isn't just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When I started this podcast, I wasn't even sure what I was doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys my products? I definitely made a fool of myself. Now I know that I was right in believing in myself and launching the podcast, despite all of the fears and the hesitations. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if I get stuck? Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And their app is just objectively super dope. It's easy to use, well-designed, and helps me keep tabs on the American Hauntings clothing store while I'm on the go, or if I'm just too lazy to stare at the big screen for any longer that day. And you can trust me, my 9-to-5 job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might get confused or break technology. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
You can find this song almost anywhere. Times have changed. It's not like you have to blow the dust off an old vinyl you found in the back of a record store. Unless you want to, so that it sounds like it was supposed to when it was released. But these days, just pull up a playlist for Billie Holiday, which you should really have, and find what was once one of her most popular songs, a tune with the uplifting name of Gloomy Sunday. Now, here's a little bit of a sample for it, but then go ahead and listen to the entire song. I'll be here when you get back. I should have told you, though, before you went to listen to the entire song, you should make sure that your windows are closed, the medicine cabinet is locked, the knives have all been put away, and the gas has been turned off on the stove. Why? Well, because Gloomy Sunday is also known as the Hungarian suicide song. Legend has it that it sent a lot of people to their deaths and ruined the lives of others, including the beautiful and talented Billie Holiday. The song was written in 1933 by a Hungarian pianist and composer named Reszló Sziris. It had a different title then, which translated roughly to "The World is Ending." It's not a very cheerful tune. About the despair that had been caused by the Great War, and it ended with a prayer for the sins of people everywhere. You're probably not surprised to hear that it wasn't a big hit. Well, a short time later, however, a poet named Laszlo Zsavar got hold of it and added his own lyrics to the melody. He turned it into a song about a young man who wanted to kill himself after his lover's death. It was just as morbidly sad, but at least it was a little more relatable. Maybe too relatable, as it turned out. Gloomy Sunday was first recorded in English in 1936 and almost immediately gained a grim reputation. The song was so depressing that even the record label described it as a suicide song. In the 1930s, radio networks started banning the song after stories began to circulate that people were killing themselves after hearing it. The stories claimed that a suicidal mania swept through Europe as confirmed cases of Gloomy Sunday madness reached epidemic proportions. One press report attributed 19 suicides to Gloomy Sunday, although those deaths are a bit hard to verify, except for two. In January 1968, the song's original composer, Reslow Saris, took his own life. He survived his initial attempt, which was jumping from a third-floor window in Budapest, but he managed to choke himself to death with a wire while he was in the hospital. Laszlo Javar, who penned the most tragic lyrics for the song, had been inspired by his own broken heart. As the controversy over the song increased, so did his fortunes from the sales of sheet music. Encouraged by what seemed to be a change in luck, he attempted to reconcile with his ex-sweetheart. He sent her a letter, but she never responded. Then, a day later, her body was discovered. She'd taken poison. The letter that Laszlo had sent her was found next to her body. She had written two words on it in large, scrawling letters. Gloomy Sunday. But verify or not, the stories of suicides continued. But why? Yes, the words and music were depressing and bleak, but there had been stranger songs that were written that didn't compel men and women to take their own lives. 15 different countries became convinced the song was cursed in some way and banned its playing on the radio. Regardless, sales continued to climb. In places where records were banned in stores, black market copies were sold. Rumors of Gloomy Sunday suicides continued, like the young boy who was cycling through the streets of Rome and heard Gloomy Sunday being sung by a street beggar. The boy emptied his pockets, gave his money to the singer, and then climbed the railing of a nearby bridge and jumped to his death in the water below. It was also an elderly man who threw himself in the window of a seven-story building after listening to the so-called suicide song in his apartment. And the stories went on, remaining a European phenomenon until it was introduced to American audiences in 1941. When the instrumental version was first recorded in the United States by Hal Kemp, who himself died an early and tragic death, more than half the musicians failed to show up for the recording session. So many weird, unexplainable things happened during that session that 21 different master copies were attempted before a final one was successfully made. One would think that the omission of the gloomy, depressing words would have ended the parade of suicides, but it was Kemp's instrumental record that was heard from an apartment window by a passing police officer in London when he discovered the body of a young woman inside. She'd taken an overdose of prescription drugs. And then came Billie Holiday's recording of the song later that same year, creating a sensation like nothing American audiences had experienced before. Billie had been born Eleonora Fagan on April 7, 1915. Her parents, Sadie Fagan, age 12, and Clarence Holiday, age 15, were children themselves. In fact, Billie attended their wedding 3 years later. She was raised in the slums of Baltimore, Maryland. Alice Dean, a neighbor who ran a brothel in Baltimore's Red Light District, allowed Billie to clean for her in return for listening to Alice's collection of jazz records. She spent hours imitating the great blues singer Bessie Smith and singing along to Louis Armstrong's famous horn. Billie lived a hard life and even spent time at a Catholic institution for wayward girls. She'd been placed there when she was 10 as the underage victim of an attempted forcible rape. After her mother got her out, they moved to New York, but things were no better there until music literally saved her life. The girl who was later nicknamed Lady Day by her friend and musical partner, Lester Young, became a tremendous influence on jazz, blues, and popular music. Even so, life was still tough for an African-American woman in the music business in those days. There was violence, drugs, and alcohol, but no one could sing like Billie. She worked with the best in the business recording amazing music, but then descended into a haze from which she never returned, starting, some say, with her recording of the cursed suicide song, Gloomy Sunday. Billie's career began with her singing in Harlem nightclubs, where she was heard by producer John Hammond. He signed her to a recording contract with Brunswick Records in 1935. Collaborations with Teddy Wilson produced the hit What a Little Moonlight Can Do, which became a jazz standard. Throughout the 1930s, Billie had mainstream success on labels like Columbia Records and Decca Records. It seemed nothing could go wrong. And then she recorded Gloomy Sunday. It became a huge hit, but her life soon went into a tailspin. Billie married Jimmy Monroe in 1941, the same year she recorded Gloomy Sunday. She quickly discovered he had a terrible heroin habit, and soon Billie was using too. Legal troubles followed thanks to her drug abuse, alcohol, and Jimmy's abuse. After a short stint in jail, she performed at a sold-out concert at Carnegie Hall, but that was nearly at the end of the road for Billie. Her drug and alcohol problems continued and her health began to deteriorate. In early 1959, she was diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. She stopped drinking for a time, but soon relapsed. On May 31st, she was taken to Metropolitan Hospital in New York with liver and heart disease, only to be arrested in the hospital for drug possession. She was under police guard when she died on July 17th. In her final years, she'd been swindled out of her royalties and earnings, and she died with just 70 cents in the bank. She was only 44 years old. It was Gloomy Sunday, her friend said. It ruined her life. Perhaps the BBC had been right about the song all along. It was so depressing they banned it from British airwaves in 1941. They felt it was detrimental to wartime morale. That ban, in England, wasn't lifted until 2002. Over 18 episodes of American Nightmares, we have mostly focused on the diabolical in American history, the devil. And there's nothing that those who exist to tell us what we can and can't do find more devilish than music. All kinds of music, but mostly jazz, blues, and rock and roll. All of which they called the devil's music at one time or another. But there's always been something strange about music, dating all the way back to medieval times. It's captured the imaginations of people in ways that nothing else has ever been able to do. This was true during the days of traveling minstrels, when folk music emerged from the Appalachian Mountains, when the first jazz music was played in the brothels of New Orleans, and when the first bluegrass songs rattled across the American South. But when the first notes of the blues, which eventually gave birth to rock and roll, began to be heard from roadhouses and juke joints, the fundamentalists were convinced that the devil himself had invented his own brand of music. And you know, maybe they're right. The origins of rock and roll are murky at best. It is, by its nature, difficult to define and even harder to explain. There may never be a single, clear-cut, universally accepted explanation for the origins of rock and roll. From its inception, it's been twisted by myth, folklore, legend, rumor, and fact. There's no other kind of music, or even type of popular culture, that has had such a rich history of depravity, untimely deaths, bizarre curses, and lives filled with excess. It's almost as if someone sold their soul to the devil to end up with the kind of rock and roll lifestyle that music can offer. One thing that we do know is that rock and roll started in the American South, springing from the loins of the blues. Now, what inspired it? Good question. We'll get to the diabolical mix of blues and rock and roll, but I'll be honest with you up front. I can't tell you how it all happened. Music is strange, and rock and roll is stranger, as were the people who created it. The history of rock and roll is sort of a gumbo. You could say it started as rockabilly, but that comes from country and hillbilly music, which came from blues, gospel, jazz, and even early experimental and classical music. And all of those things had one thing in common. They were created as a revolt against convention. Music came from the ancient impulse to hammer out sounds on whatever tools were available, expressing what it meant to be human. For thousands of years, making music was inseparable from religious activity. It was a way to worship the gods, and later on, just one god, when the mainstream churches tried to erase and demonize all the old ones. And just as the church did back then, ministers, parents, and record-burning do-gooders recognized the threat caused by all kinds of popular music, especially rock and roll, in modern-day America. The response of the musicians was what saved music itself. They pushed back, literally shaking their hips in the face of religious authority. Rock and roll turned the values of traditional religion on its head. Because the mainstream church often saw sex, especially in the 1950s when rock and roll was born, as a symptom of ungodliness and the influence of evil spirits. Rock musicians started a rebellion when they plugged in their amps and they got teenagers dancing. And rock and roll, like the blues and jazz before it, became the devil's music. It wasn't the first kind of music to be called that, of course, as we'll soon see, but the label has certainly stuck. Rock's first words were sexual, drawn from explicit blues lyrics and the very physical nature of its rhythms. And of course, where sex is, the devil is always lurking nearby. Rock and roll, like sex, was something that religious authorities and parents wanted young people to be afraid of. But fear can be a funny thing. Deep down, we want to feel afraid, which strengthens our desire for things like music, sex, the supernatural, and the occult. There are temptations, especially when they lead us to people who dare to defy convention and who place themselves outside of the mainstream. Society has long believed that music is a kind of magic, going back to the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, who lured the children in the village away with his flute. Music can electrify both the listener and the one who plays it. Rumors of the occult, particularly stories of deals with the devil, both attract and repel us. We delved into the story of Robert Johnson in an earlier episode, but Robert was not the first musician who allegedly made a deal with the devil. Niccolò Paganini, a 19th century composer and violin virtuoso, was accused of consorting with the devil, who helped him to astonish his listeners with his skillful playing. The young man's physical appearance only encouraged the rumor. He was pale and extremely thin, with long black hair that fell across his face as he performed. Women were said to have screamed and fainted as he produced music that was described as otherworldly. Rumor swirled. He was a gambler, a killer, a cruel seducer of women, but it was his musical ability that caused the most speculation. Surely, the story said, he'd sold his soul to the devil. No one could naturally play like he did. Some claim they even saw the devil himself pulling the violin bow as Niccolò's fingers flew across the instrument's neck. Once before he was allowed to perform in France, he was forced to bring a note from his mother stating that the devil was not his father. But rumors of Niccolò selling his soul to the devil did not keep devout Italian Catholics away from his music. While it took a mental toll on the musician, who just wanted to be recognized for his own talent, the idea that he'd sold himself to the devil added to his reputation and increased the sizes of the audiences at his concerts. Paganini began a long tradition of musicians that flirted with or openly embraced the occult. All the essential genres, from blues to heavy metal, from goth to glam, toyed with the supernatural. Magic and mysticism became an integral part of rock and roll starting in the 1960s. It could have gone another way and become merely a fusion of American blues and folk without its own identity. Instead, some of the biggest names in popular music willingly participated in a sort of spiritual rebellion. The Beatles, Led Zeppelin, David Bowie, the Rolling Stones, Black Sabbath, and many others not only transformed rock by embracing the occult, but kept it from remaining a series of redundant chords that spun over and over again on AM radio. This will be the first of our episodes about the history of the devil's music, and we'll be bouncing back and forth between our episodes of The Devil at the Movies in the weeks ahead. I'm sure there will be a few explanatory side trips along the way, but I hope you dig the music and mayhem still to come. You might wonder why this is the direction that I decided to go with American Nightmares, but hey, like Elvis once said about the way the music made his hips shake, I just can't help it. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror in every form, starting, of course, with our exploration of the devil and all his works. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 18, The Devil's Music. Part 1. The Devil's Music. You're going to hear that a lot in the episodes ahead. Over the centuries, it's a term that's been used to describe everything from jazz to the blues to rock and roll. But at one time, religious leaders weren't just referring to a certain type of music as being dangerous to the souls of those who listened to it. They truly believed that some music was literally the work of the devil himself. In the Middle Ages, the church taught its followers that music was a gift from God and that it was only supposed to be played in celebration of the Lord. This meant that any form of secular music was not only disapproved of, but was considered to be a glorification of the devil. But even within some religious music, the church tried to discourage composers from using certain intervals of music, such as what was called the augmented fourth interval of the Tritonus, a spooky little ditty, I guess, that was really only used by Gregorian monks when they sang about the apocalypse. Plain music that was written in praise of God was supposed to sound pleasant. For composers of the day, this was easy to arrange. You take a C major scale, you know, just the white keys on the piano, and plunk out any two-note combination, and you'll find that they're all religious-grade harmonies. Except one. Played in sequence, or together, the notes F, B, D-sharp, and G-sharp clash in a way that feels eerie, unnatural, and foreboding. If you're reading this and don't have a piano handy, think of the first notes of Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix, or American Police Sirens. It's actually the same tune. You could see how that would be unsettling, right? Before composers began using major and minor scales, this interval was considered so unnatural that it was called the devil's interval. It was believed that using this interval could literally summon the devil. Well, at least that's what the stories say. To explain it further, if you change one of the notes slightly, the dissonance turns to harmony. What's really happening when we hear dissonance has to do with the relationship between frequencies. The two pitches of the devil's interval created a much more complicated ratio of frequencies than other intervals and are therefore much harder for the human ear to sort out. This demonic combination was considered off-limits in medieval times, though there's no historical evidence to say that it was banned outright. The devil's interval was occasionally used, although it was always under the gravest of musical circumstances, like when talking about the apocalypse or Christ's crucifixion. Even during the 17th and 18th centuries, after the church's influence over cultural traditions had faded somewhat, composers continued to avoid the devil's interval. In the odd passages where tritones appeared, their use was technical to create and then quickly resolve tension. Then, suddenly, at the dawn of the Romantic era of classical music, it returned in Act 2 of Beethoven's 1805 opera, Fidelio. As the scene opens in a dungeon, at about the 1:20 point in the recording, for those who are playing along at home, the kettle drums rumble with menace, tuned in at the devil's interval. After Beethoven took his shot at it, something like an obsession followed, with composers using tritones to probe the darkest corners of humanity. Probably the best known from this period is Danse Macabre by Camille Saint-Saëns, which we'll return to in a moment. Another Frenchman, Hector Berlioz, boldly subjected listeners to the devil's interval in the opening of an aria, and no surprise, it was about damnation. Another famous example appears in the combination of two tritone intervals during Siegfried's funeral march, Twilights of the Gods. Now, I won't subject you to me trying to fumble my way through the German name for it, but it's in the final opera of Wagner's Ring cycle. Franz Liszt, the Hungarian composer and piano virtuoso, also used tritones for ghastly effect. For example, to evoke Dante's descent into hell in the opening notes of his Dante Sonata. While Romantic composers were getting into the devil's interval, they were also experimenting with another snippet of Catholic Church music that was used to evoke doom, the haunting theme from a 13th century Gregorian chant called the Dies Irae, which translates from Latin to the uplifting phrase, Day of Wrath. When it was sung a cappella style by monks, it was pretty eerie, but when composers began using it to conjure up music, it became downright sinister. Hector Berlioz, the Frenchman who gets credit for a lot of creepy music in his career, created a blood-curdling tune when he invoked it in his 1830 work, Symphonie Fantastique. Now that's another sample, but listen to the whole thing. Once again, I'll wait. If you listened, it's a pretty freaky piece of music, even without the apocalyptic snippet. This piece is essentially about a bad trip that turns horrifying, and I don't mean a road trip. It tells the story of an artist who, believing himself rejected by the woman that he's stalking, tries to overdose on opium. In the hallucination that results, he ends up killing the woman, being beheaded, and then witnessing his funeral turn into a witch's Sabbath. Who says the French don't like to party? Well, you may not be shocked to learn that Berlioz was a pretty accomplished stalker in real life, or that most historians believe that he composed Symphonie Fantastique while stoned on opium. He also once hatched a bumbling and luckily failed plan to murder his former fiancée. The Dies Irae comes in during the final movement with the dancing witches and a diabolical orgy. And just so you know, the orgy starts at about the 3:25 mark. Although I'm not sure why you need to know that. Anyway, the use of the theme spread from Berlioz's drug trip and started showing up in the works of Brahms, Tchaikovsky, Chopin, and Rachmaninoff, who wins the prize for using the Dies Irae the most. Although Franz Liszt, who happened to be in the audience at the 1830 premiere of Symphonie Fantastique, was the composer who became obsessed with it. A pioneer of really complicated piano pieces, Liszt had a real passion for the devil, for death, and other dark subjects, and unsurprisingly, featured either the Dies Irae or the Devil's Interval, or both, in several pieces, including Dante's Sonata and his Mephisto Waltz. His Danse Macabre is a devilishly fevered work for piano and orchestra. It opens with the Dies Irae and uses the Devil's Interval throughout the whole thing. The Danse Macabre, or Dance of Death, refers to a medieval allegory in which the dead rise and dance with the living to remind them of their mortality. This idea became a popular subject of frescoes and cemetery murals across Europe. The French, morbid as they were, pushed the Danse Macabre into the realm of celebration. And it wasn't just in their artwork. They dressed up corpses at village fairs and court parties to act it out. Yes, you heard that correctly. Actual dead bodies. A story even began that claimed that at the stroke of midnight on All Hallows' Eve, death showed up and summoned the dead to dance with him. The most enduring rendition of the Dance of Death and the biggest Halloween hit of the 19th century came from Frenchman Camille Saint-Saëns. His 1870 work, Dance Macabre, not an imaginative title, but it featured the doom-filled combination of the Devil's Interval and the Dies Irae. The piece begins with 12 plucks of harp string depicting a bell tolling at midnight. Then in comes the Devil's Interval with almost painful screeches of a solo violin that's played by Death. Well, that's just a sample, but seriously, even that has to sound familiar, but go listen to the whole thing. You're going to recognize the song from a dozen different films and commercials, and it shows up in horror films for a very good reason. Now, I'm not a fan of classical music, but if I have to have some favorites, that's definitely one of them. It is eerie stuff. The Dies Irae appears about halfway through the piece, but by then, it was an old trope. More innovative were the other eerie methods of bringing in the horror, like the xylophone emulating the cracking of bones. When the oboe sounds like the crowing of the rooster, the dead go back to their graves and the whole party comes to an end. You don't hear the Dies Irae a lot after that, but the Devil's Interval has never gone away. Stanley Kubrick used it in the opening music for The Shining, and it's made it into horror classics like The Exorcist and Poltergeist. As mentioned already, Jimi Hendrix used it, and among heavy metal bands, it's reached cult status, so to speak. Lots of groups have included it in their music, but perhaps the most famous use of it is in the opening of Black Sabbath's song, Black Sabbath, in 1970. While metal bands have carried on the innovation of the Devil's Interval from the Romantic era, other genres have broadened its appeal. In the first notes of the song Maria from West Side Story, composer Leonard Bernstein used it to create a weird tension. Danny Elfman did the same thing in the opening notes of the theme song to The Simpsons. Its wider popularity these days probably has something to do with the fact that death and the devil aren't quite as frightening as they were 200 years ago. Or that religious folks soon found other kinds of devil's music to worry about. Jazz music is, without a doubt, an American invention. That's about the only thing that we know about it for sure, other than it originated within the African-American communities of New Orleans in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Even though jazz has its roots in the blues, ragtime, traditional African music, and spirituals, it's unlike any other kind of music that exists. It is one of America's original art forms, and despite what many have claimed, it was not actually born in the red light districts of New Orleans. It just seemed that way, because it was there where jazz became famous. That also helped to turn it into history's next version of the devil's music. The new sound was born sometime in the middle 1890s in the working class black clubs and honky-tonks in the uptown neighborhood of New Orleans. You could hear it in the venues in and around South Rampart Street and further away in the dives on the other side of Canal. For a time, the music was only known to those who went to such places, but before long, it was being heard in parks, on street corners, in dance halls, and well beyond the confines of the African-American neighborhoods. And of course, that's when the trouble started. It's believed to have been a young cornet player from Uptown named Buddy Bolden who first played the music later known as jazz. Certainly, many others, black, mixed race, and even white, would later lay claim to the distinction, but many of his contemporaries believe that it was Buddy who started it all. For many people in New Orleans, accustomed to straighter, more schooled forms of music, the new sound was a revelation. Charles Joseph Buddy Bolden, like most of the jazzmen that followed him, grew up poor with few prospects. The grandson of slaves was born in September 1877 in a small house on Howard Street in Uptown. It was a tough place to live. On the edge of a dank, foul-smelling canal, Buddy had lost his father, one sister, and his grandmother to various illnesses by the time he was 6 years old. Buddy and his sister Cora moved around with their mother Alice for a few years, staying with relatives and friends, and then finally settled in a shotgun house on First Street, a tough but integrated neighborhood that was populated mostly by German and Irish immigrants who had little trouble getting along with their black neighbors. Alice made a modest living there, taking in laundry, earning enough to keep her children in school. Buddy grew up around music. In New Orleans, then as now, it was everywhere. He heard it played in the streets, in parks, and in church, but he had no musical training of any kind until 1894, when his mother allowed him to take cornet lessons from a neighbor, a short-order cook named Manuel Hall. He was 16 by then, which was a late start for a musician, but Buddy learned quickly. He soon found lots of opportunities to play. The city's brass bands would sometimes have long work days, playing funerals or other affairs that went on from early morning to late at night. When they needed a break or a beer, they'd have young men like Buddy fill in for them. By 1897, though, he was playing with his own regular band at parades and picnics. And despite, or more likely because of, his lack of formal training, he was soon attracting attention for taking street songs, hymns, and dance tunes and creating a musical sound that people were unfamiliar with. The Bolden sound, to hear witnesses describe it, was, quote, hot, wide open, and low down. It was bluesy, and it made you want to jump up and dance. You won't find any recordings of Buddy today, but you can get an idea of his sound by searching out the Buddy Bolden Legacy Band. Give him a listen, and you'll understand how groundbreaking this sound was for the time. Buddy couldn't read music very well, but that didn't matter much since he could pick up anything he needed by ear. He borrowed sounds from other bands and got ideas from everywhere, including from the Holler Roller churches that he sometimes attended with his mother and sister. The music was electric. It was showy, sometimes raunchy, and always very, very loud. Soon, the Bolden Band was attracting a lot of attention and a lot of imitators. Even some of the older musicians took notice. There were plenty of bandleaders in the city already making innovative music, but Buddy was taking things in a whole new direction. Buddy played the first blues for dancing, many said, and younger musicians were quick to pick up on the new sound. Musicians like Freddie Capard, Pops Foster, Bunk Johnson, Big Eye Lewis Nelson, Willie Cornish, Frankie Dewson, and even a young Creole piano player named Jelly Roll Morton were soon doing their own innovations, taking old tunes and making up new ones and putting their own personalities into the mix. Now, what exactly were they playing? Well, that's still up for debate, but critics have tried to trace its lineage to African, Caribbean, French, or Spanish roots, to ragtime, to various religious forms, to traditions like the blues. But really, it was just a completely new music, created by untrained musicians who were just doing whatever the hell they wanted. Buddy was riding high with his new sound. Other musicians had noticed, but so had the ladies. He was soon a local celebrity in Uptown, traveling around with a harem of female admirers who would fight one another to hold his hat, his coat, and even his handkerchief. And he loved the attention. Eventually, though, the new music played by Buddy and the others became so popular, especially among working-class audiences, both black and white, that it started drawing unwanted attention, too. The police would show up at so-called cutting contests, where two bands would meet and try to outplay each other, and start cracking heads so that they could restore order. City reformers also took notice, and they didn't like what they heard. To their ears, the new sound was dangerous, an affront to their notions of respectability, restraint, temperance, and civil order. The new black music represented excess and sexuality, a direct violation of traditional moral values. Worst of all, it promoted contact, much of it the most scandalous type, across the color line. This was intolerable to most Southern whites of the era. Even before Buddy began to make his mark, reformers had started protesting the detrimental effects of what they classily called coon music. And now, with the rising popularity of Buddy and his peers, black music in New Orleans had taken an ominous new turn. Jazz was considered the musical mixing of races, and for the racists who wanted order, white purity, and respectability, that meant it had to be suppressed. They saw jazz as a challenge to the Jim Crow laws of the time because it brought black and white audiences together. And they were right. Jazz was, in a very real sense, an expression of defiance, rebelling against the increasing efforts to marginalize and suppress African Americans, which meant it was seen as a threat to the entire social order of the time period. Organized efforts to stop the development of jazz began with sporadic attempts at intimidation, like a band at a party broken up here, a racially mixed street party raided by the police there, that sort of thing. In 1896, during one of the city's occasional smallpox outbreaks, an effort was made to close the notorious, quote, Negro dives of Franklin Street. It was allegedly for health reasons, but it was really just to shut down the jazz clubs. Regardless, the effort failed. And then came Storyville, where it was hoped that jazz music could be as easily segregated and contained as prostitution would be. It was the first phase of the city's efforts to reform. By putting everything disreputable and disruptive in one place, it would make it easier to control. Or so they thought. Back in the New Orleans season of the American Hauntings podcast, we did an entire episode about the rise and fall of Storyville. So I'm not going to revisit its entire history here. All you need to know is that the authorities in New Orleans in the 1890s believe they can control the rampant prostitution in the city by creating a 5-square block area, a segregated red light district that would contain all the city's brothels and vice. It was dubbed Storyville in dubious honor of Alderman Sidney Story, who proposed the ordinance that created it in 1897. Within a few years, Storyville became the most celebrated red light district in the United States, and tourists came from all over to see and experience it. In addition to vice, it also served as an important venue for jazz music. At first, the establishments of the district were reluctant to hire musicians. If customers were busy dancing, after all, they wouldn't be buying drinks or time with the women. But eventually, the new music became too popular to ignore. Buddy Bolden's band, as well as other hot ensembles, were soon playing regularly at the clubs in the district. Storyville may not be the birthplace of jazz, as has sometimes been claimed, but it did provide employment for many early jazzmen, and helping to bring their music to a wider audience, a usually non-black audience. Of course, this was what earned jazz its early reputation as, quote, whorehouse music. But the musicians that played it didn't much care so long as they had an audience and they were getting paid. The music spread far and wide, thanks to the visiting reporters who were writing stories about the brothels of Storyville. This connected jazz and vice for their readers, and whether the connection was deserved or not, Storyville began the careers of many musicians who went on to great fame, as well as hundreds of others for whom no recordings remain today. Unlike jazz, though, Storyville didn't last. It was doomed by America's entrance into World War I in 1917. In August, Secretary of War Newton D. Baker issued an order forbidding open prostitution within 5 miles of military bases and ports. The business owners of Storyville, as well as city officials, appealed the decision, but it was no use. Storyville closed, but it didn't really put too many people out of work. The jazzmen, along with brothel madams and their girls, simply moved on to new locations in New Orleans and kept plying their trade. By the time Storyville closed, though, Buddy Bolden was no longer playing the music he essentially created. You see, by 1917, Buddy had lost his mind. Before that happened, though, Buddy was around to see jazz thanks to its association with sex, alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, and racial mixing start being described as an affront to the decency of many people in New Orleans, both white and black. The growing number of violent incidents occurring in places where the music was played didn't help the situation. Drunken brawls had become common and arrests were happening every weekend. Buddy himself was even arrested once for assault, even though he'd been on stage playing music and trying to settle everyone down. Buddy had become such a threat to the white establishment that when he played his most popular tune, which was called "I Thought I Heard Buddy Bolden Say," he was arrested. Even the way that Jasmine dressed was considered offensive. A lot of the players wouldn't wear anything but a coat with no shirt and trousers that were very tight. That was the look. And for Buddy, one of his suspenders would always be hanging down and his shirt would be open so that his undershirt could be seen beneath it. But Buddy's days as the leader of a defiant subculture would turn out to be tragically brief. His popularity peaked in 1905. By then, it was enough just to see Buddy. You didn't even have to hear him play. But whenever he practiced on his front steps, neighborhood children would gather around him on the sidewalk to dance, and, well, his effect on women became the stuff of legend. But celebrity eventually took its toll. In March 1906, Buddy began to experience severe headaches. He seemed to be disoriented at times, failed to recognize his friends, and would walk the streets speaking incoherently to strangers. Sometimes his mother and sister would send his friend, Lewis Jones, to find him and bring him home. Buddy even developed a fear of his own coronet. No one really knows what happened to Buddy. Some said that he drank too much and slept too little. Others said he simply couldn't handle the pressure of having to stay one step ahead of the competition so that he didn't become yesterday's news. His friend Lewis Jones had a simpler but less poetic explanation. He believed Buddy was ruined by an untreated ear infection. Well, whatever the cause, he fell apart. He was eventually even kicked out of his own band. After Buddy failed to pay his band members once too often, they started arranging their own gigs without him. In the spring of 1906, while bedridden and being cared for by his mother and a neighbor woman, Ida Bass, Buddy became violent. Convinced he was being poisoned, he jumped out of bed and attacked Mrs. Bass with a water pitcher. She suffered only a minor head wound, but Buddy, well, he was calmed down again, but the two women weren't taking any chances. Worried that more violence might follow, they had him arrested on a charge of insanity. He was held in jail for a few days and then released. But Buddy didn't get any better. His last gig was a Labor Day parade later that same year. It was a huge parade, and virtually every musician in the city was playing in it. Before the march was over, though, Buddy had to drop out. He spent a troubled week at home, and by Saturday, he was so out of it that his mother had him arrested on another insanity charge. He was released again after a few days. That's how mental illness was treated back then. But now he was too far gone to help. He spent the winter self-medicating with liquor, and then on March 13, 1907, Alice Bolden had her son arrested for the third and final time. Buddy was held in the House of Detention for several weeks before he was finally transferred to the State Insane Asylum in Jackson, Louisiana. He remained there for the rest of his life, and he died on November 4, 1931. The first king of jazz was gone, but there weren't many musicians in New Orleans who carried on and expanded on his legacy. One of them was just a small boy when Buddy was locked away. He would later tell conflicting stories about whether he really remembered hearing Buddy play, but it's likely that he did. He lived close to the Funky Butt Hall and remembered listening when he was a boy of four or five, when Buddy was at his peak, to the band that played Saturday night dances at the hall. That boy's name was Louis Armstrong, and he would eventually do more than anyone in history to spread Buddy's new sound beyond the confines of New Orleans and out into the rest of the world. But not every young musician in New Orleans at the time was pulled into the volatile world of Buddy Bolden and the Uptown Jazzmen. Jelly Roll Morton, whose actual name was Ferdinand Joseph Lementh, was a Creole pianist and a stunningly original musician. He developed a unique blend of piano-based ragtime, dance music, and blues. It was a style that eventually could make its own claim to being the source of the kind of music that was still a decade away from being known as jazz. Like many Creoles of the era, Morton grew up in an atmosphere saturated with music. His godmother, Eulalie Echo, paid for guitar lessons for him when he was a very young boy, and by the time he was 7, he was an accomplished musician, playing in a 3-piece string band that performed at night in the 7th Ward. One day at a party, he heard a man playing ragtime on the piano and decided that was the instrument for him. He began studying with a series of teachers and soon earned a reputation around town for his skills. One Saturday night, he and some friends were enjoying a night in Storyville, and he was approached by someone looking for a pianist to fill in at one of the district's sporting houses. Morton, who was only 15 at the time, agreed to do it, but insisted his friends come along with him for moral support. The madam, as well as some of her girls, were impressed by his talent and tipped him $20, which was a lot of money at the time. At the end of the night, he was offered a job as the brothel's regular player. He hesitated at first, wondering what his proper Creole family might think, but he eventually took the gig and just told his family he'd switch to the night shift at his regular job at a barrel-making factory. He soon became a fixture in Storyville and became perhaps the most famous musician to emerge from the district. Jelly Roll became a favorite among the brothel women, who often leaned on their customers to get him big tips. Soon he was making more money than he'd ever seen in his life. He eventually had a diamond implanted in one of his front teeth and bought a loud new suit, a Stetson hat, and a pair of St. Louis flat shoes with toes that turned up at the ends almost to his ankles. That was the suit he was wearing when he ran into his great-grandmother on the street one Sunday morning. She was returning home from church, and it was obvious to her that her great-grandson was not. It turned out to be a life-changing encounter. When his grandmother, who he'd been living with since his mother's death the year before, heard about it, she kicked him out of the house. At the age of 16, he was on his own. Jelly Roll remained the most popular musician in Storyville until it closed in 1917. After that, the Jazzmen kept playing the clubs and dives around town, but the district shutdown severely reduced the number of places where they could play. Bands cut back on the number of players in their roster, replacing their guitarists, bassists, and violinists, often with a single pianist. With fewer gigs available, many Jazzmen were forced to return to their day jobs. Some of them, thanks to the worsening employment picture, began to look for opportunities elsewhere. Many started new bands and began touring on the vaudeville circuit. Others followed their lead over the next few years and drifted out of the city looking for work. Jelly Roll Morton was one of them. He'd already been spending much of his time on the road and was soon finding new opportunities and more receptive audiences in Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles. His reputation grew as time passed, and he became widely recognized for his originality and his influence on the world of jazz. But as with many great musicians, rumors swirled about his rise to fame. Legend had it that Jelly Roll's godmother, Eulalie Echo, who had first encouraged his love of music, was a practitioner of voodoo, a form of folk magic brought to New Orleans from Africa and the Caribbean in the early 19th century. The stories claim that Eulalie sold Jelly Roll's soul to the devil as part of a black magic ritual to ensure his success. This was despite the fact that voodoo has nothing to do with black magic. But truth or fiction, it wasn't Jelly Roll's only brush with the supernatural. Throughout the 1930s, Jelly Roll had his own office in New York, trying to break into the music publishing business, where all the big money was being made. One of his employees, a young man from the West Indies, stole several of Morton's musical scores and sold them to another company. Jelly Roll promptly fired him. The next day, a strange colored powder was found sprinkled around his office door. Convinced that a hex had been placed on him, Jelly Roll's luck began to fail. His music scores, money, and collection of diamonds were stolen. Work that he'd been promised was offered to Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway instead. Jelly Roll became so discouraged he finally decided to quit the music business and invest what money he had left in a cosmetics company that he had been assured was a sure thing. It wasn't. After it failed, he had almost nothing left. In desperation, he went to see an old hoodoo woman who told him that the only way to break the curse was to destroy all his clothing. Jelly Roll later recalled, quote, "I always had a lot of clothes, and the stack I made in my backyard was way over the top of my head. I poured on the kerosene and struck a match. It like to broke my heart to watch my suits burn." Whether there was really a curse on him or not, the hoodoo woman's advice worked. By the end of the 1930s, the jazz world developed a fascination with traditional New Orleans music, or what they called authentic jazz, as opposed to the swing style that had taken America by storm. Jelly Roll Morton, who had been playing for room and board at a Washington nightclub, his music all but forgotten, was suddenly a major attraction all over again. White college students armed with notepads began to filter into the seedy nightclub where he'd been playing just so they could see a living legend. Jelly Roll was baffled. He felt his music was very much alive. He could easily outswing the modern players like Chick Webb and Count Basie, but he still wasn't making any money. When Alan Lomax, the jazz historian, invited Morton to the Library of Congress to record his life story in 1938, Jelly was down to pretty much his last dime. But in 1939, Victor Records, hoping to cash in on the New Orleans jazz revival, offered Jelly Roll a new recording contract. The publicity painted a picture of Jelly Roll emerging from seclusion to record a great new album, but in truth, he'd been saved from poverty and from being forgotten. At last, he was rightfully taking his place as one of the most important figures in an original American art form. But Jelly Roll's days were numbered, and he knew it. In 1941, his voodoo godmother, Eulalie Echo, died. As Jelly Roll's girlfriend, Anita Gonzalez, told Alan Lomax, quote, "Jelly always knew she'd sold him to Satan, and that when she died, he'd died too, and she'd take him down with her." 2 months after Eulalie passed, Jelly Roll died on July 10, 1941. He was only 46 years old. I always like to think that even though Jelly Roll followed Eulalie to the grave, the story of her deal with the devil wasn't true. You hate to think that someone as talented as Jelly Roll Morton would be stuck playing the piano for the devil for eternity. On the other hand, he definitely wouldn't be alone down there, because I'm sure that the devil has got a hell of a band. Thanks for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows on the network and recommend them to friends, family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. To say thanks for your support, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really a small business that's grateful for everything you do for us. We couldn't and wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. As long as the devil doesn't get you first.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.